So Norman had planned for this month of May to study three different fascicles of Dogen's from the Shobo Genzo that are about karma. And so he suggested that I speak on that subject or on one or more of them and on karma. And as it happens, karma is one of my favorite topics. It means a lot to me, and it's very dear to my heart. I'm going to talk about, I'm going to touch on two of the three fascicles in the Shobo Genzo tonight. And I also, in my thinking, I found an old issue of Turning Wheel, which I used to edit, the magazine of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I edited that for years, and I remembered that we had a special issue focused on karma, and I looked that issue up. It was from 2001, and it was full of some interesting articles on karma, which I might refer to during the course of the evening. So as I was, and I didn't have very much time to prepare this talk, it came up suddenly. So I am very at home with my family sangha here, and I feel your support, and I know you will bear with me for not having a super organized talk tonight, but I will be going from one thought to the next, and we'll have some time for breakout discussion, and I look forward to sharing the evening with you. As I was thinking about it, I was just thinking how incredibly amazing it is that I'm part of a group of people who like to sit around and talk about what does karma mean, this abstract word from an ancient religion, and how it has so much to do with our lives. And we know that it has to do with our own real lived lives. And I get to talk to people who feel that way as I do, and to share our feelings about this. And that's an amazing, it moves me a lot, actually. So to launch in, well, the laws of karma are to me really about the precepts. This is so foundational. And the most familiar of the koan, the fascicles that Norman mentioned to me that he wants to take up this month is already something familiar to you, many of you, most of you probably, which is Baijan's fox. We know it for short as Baijan's fox. And that was a topic that was taken up very recently in a series of talks that Norman and Chris gave together on koans from the Mano Shobo Genzo, the 300 koans. And one of the ones they talked about was Baijan's fox. So here it comes again quite soon after. And I want to start with a little bit from that. You already have some background on that, but I wanted to start by reading the beginning of that fascicle. And in this translation that I'm using Kazutanahashi's edition, two-volume edition of the Shobo Genzo, or Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, translated by Kazutanahashi. So this is the beginning of what he calls identifying with cause and effect. Every time Baijiang, Zen Master Daji, gave a Dharma talk, an old man would come to listen. He usually left after the talk, but one day he remained behind. Baijiang asked, "Who is there?" The man said, "I am not actually a human being. I lived and taught on this mountain at the time of Kashyapa Buddha. One day, a student asked me, 'Does a person who practices completely still fall into cause and effect?' I said to him, 'No, such a person does not fall into cause and effect.' because I said this, I was made to be reborn as a wild fox for 500 lifetimes. So I'm going to stop there for now. And I want to kind of revisit some of this language here. So that the man who is speaking to Baijiang was himself the abbot in the same position as Baijiang. And he was also called Baijiang. He was kind of Baijiang number one. They're both named after the mountain, I think, where they were. And so the former Baijiang, now a fox, we're told, is asking again about this koan. And he tells the story that back when he was abbot, a student asked him, does a person who practices completely, now from this, I take this to mean, does an awakened being, an enlightened person, an abbot like you, does such a person fall into cause and effect? And then I translate fall into cause and effect as, is this person subject to cause and effect? Which it sometimes is translated that way in other translations. Fall into cause and effect is a little ambiguous, maybe deliberately so in this translation, but Dogen makes it very clear in his discussion that he takes this to mean subject to the laws of cause and effect, subject to karmic, you could say retribution, karmic. If you break a precept, are you subject to the karma that comes from that? That's the question. And the answer he gave was no. Such a person, if you're awakened like me, you are not subject to the laws of cause and effect. You can rise above them. That's how I take this to mean, what I take this to mean. So now this man is standing before Baijiang and he's telling him this. And he says to him, Reverend Master, please say a turning word for me and free me from this wild fox body. Then he asked Baijiang, does a person who practices completely still fall into cause and effect? So he asks the same question that he was asked 500 lifetimes ago, to which he apparently gave the wrong answer. He asks Baijiang that question. Baijiang said, do not ignore cause and effect. Immediately, the man had great realization. So, no, you can't ignore it. You can't rise above it. You have to pay attention to it. And again, do not ignore cause and effect is a little bit ambiguous. Is he saying, yes, you're subject to the laws of cause and effect? And it's pretty clear from Dogen's commentary in here that to Dogen, that means, yes, you are definitely subject to the laws of cause and effect. You can't rise above it. You can't step away from it. So this is really not a vague idea. It's not an abstract idea. It's not a scholarly construct that has nothing to do with us. It's about how we human beings act in our lives. And we know of Zen teachers, Zen masters, and other wise people and ordinary people too, but people like Baijiang, people in the position of Baijiang, we know that such people can also say, no, I am not subject to the laws of cause and effect in some sense. We know of people who have committed sexual misconduct or misused the resources of the monastery and who may have said, either in so many words or in effect, I was intimate with my student for her own good, or I was driving a Rolls Royce for the good of the monastery. I know what I'm doing. I have good reasons for this. In a way, saying I'm not subject to the laws of cause and effect. Or perhaps a more generous interpretation of such cases might also be that the person knows that they're doing something they shouldn't really be doing, but they're frail human beings and they go astray and perhaps they hope they'll get away with it. And I am not here trying to throw stones at people because I too have fooled myself and I know that I have sometimes made myself an exception to some rule or other. So I think all of us have this experience to some degree. So I'm really not trying to be blaming, but I'm pointing out how Dogen is really trying to get us to see that everybody, no matter how awakened you are, in fact or in theory, you are still subject to cause and effect. If you are a human being on this planet, you're accountable for your actions. And as I was getting ready to talk and rereading this koan, I noticed something in the koan and in the fascicle that I hadn't really noticed before, which is very clear and right up there, but somehow I hadn't focused on it, which interested me. So what was the error of the first Baizhang number one, that caused him to have to be reborn 500 lifetimes as a fox? What precept did he break? Well, he didn't steal or kill or commit sexual misconduct or get drunk or lie, as far as we know. It's not in the story. He didn't break a specific precept. What he did was he denied causation itself. He denied the truth of the precepts. And that was his big error. And Dogen makes this point over and over, that it was his denial of cause and effect that was his very deep error, his deeply unwholesome action. I'm assuming that this fascicle was a talk that Dogen gave probably at Eheji. It was later in his life, I think. And he was not telling the monks to be good because they already knew what the precepts were. He wasn't reminding them not to steal and lie. He was telling them, he was speaking at a deeper level and saying, if you deny cause and effect, if you deny that the law of karma applies to you, that in itself is a deeply wholesome act. And to quote from the end of that fascicle, Dogen says, if you deny causation, endless harm results. Even if you do nothing more than deny cause and effect, this is a disastrous, poisonous view. Immediately clarify all causes and all effects if you want to make the aspiration for enlightenment your priority, and so respond to the boundless gift of Buddha ancestors. So what does this have to do with us? It has everything to do with us. Everything. It means you can't get away with anything. There have been situations in which I have persuaded myself that if I do something that is technically breaking a precept, if I get away with it and nobody notices, maybe it doesn't really count. And I've known people who really operate on that basis. They seem like ordinary people, and they figure, well, it's a kind of measure of action that it's okay if you get away with it. If nobody notices, then what harm have you done? So if you can get away with it, it's okay. This is a kind of widespread belief, I think, in our culture. And it's certainly not in our Dharma teachings. And I think we practitioners pretty much don't have that attitude. But it's very present in the world that we live in. And I really appreciate Dogen for reminding us so strongly that nobody gets away with anything, even an awakened Zen master. There's no such thing as getting away with something. And I really appreciate my Sangha brothers and sisters for caring about this subject with me. So I want to turn now and really focus on a different fascicle, one of the other two that Norman suggested. And this one is, it's number 85 in the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And it's called Karma in the Three Periods. And I will read you the first paragraph of this one. Venerable Kumaralabdha, the 19th ancestor, journeyed to central India, where he met a seeker called Jayata, who asked him, "My parents follow the path of the three treasures, but they have been sick and nothing they do goes well. Our next door neighbors have been engaged in the low practice of slaughtering animals, yet they are healthy and content. How come they are happy while we are so unfortunate?" So this is one of the most basic questions about karma. Why do bad things happen to good people? If there's such a thing as the law of karma, then bad things wouldn't happen to good people and good things wouldn't happen to bad people. Doesn't make sense. It's not fair. But that's if you look only at this lifetime. So to go on to the next paragraph of this fascicle, Kumaralabdha is answering the question of Jayata, why are my parents having such a hard time even though they've been good? He says, "Why should you doubt? The results from our wholesome and unwholesome actions take effect in the three periods. But people only see that the peaceful die young and the violent live long, or that the unrighteous prosper and the righteous decline. So they deny the law of cause and effect and say that our sins and good deeds are without consequences. They do not know that the shadows and echoes follow our actions without a hair's breadth gap. The results of our actions don't get worn away, even 100, 1,000, or 10,000 eons. Hearing these words, Jayata was freed from his doubt. So that's what Dogen is saying. That's what Kumaralabdha is saying in Dogen's story. He's saying to Jayata, you might not see it in this lifetime, but the results of karma happen in the three periods. So then later in the fascicle, Dogen explains there are three periods for the fruition of karma. And those three periods are this lifetime that we're in right now, the next lifetime is the second period, and the third period is all the other lifetimes. It could be the third lifetime, or it could be this 100th lifetime. It's some future lifetime. So our karma bears fruit in either this lifetime or the next lifetime or an even further into the future lifetime. Those are the three periods. So Dogen is saying, well, that's what clears up the mystery here when you say, well, why are my parents suffering even though they've been so good? And why are these other people doing so well even though they have misbehaved? Sometimes you see the results of wholesome actions in this lifetime or the results of unwholesome actions in this lifetime, and sometimes you don't see them until later. And he tells, then Dogen goes on to give examples of the fruition of karma in each of these three periods. And he gives an example of what the effects of wholesome acts in this lifetime, and an example of the effects of unwholesome action in this lifetime. And then he does the same for the next lifetime and the lifetimes after that. And the fascicle is quite schematic and kind of dividing up things into different lifetimes. And he talks about different categories of ends and different versions of karmic, I don't know, I really like to use the word retribution, but karmic consequences. And it's kind of complicated, and I didn't have time to dive into it deeply enough for tonight to really be able to unpack all the different parts that he is saying. But I can bring to you some things from this koan, from this fascicle. And I wanted to, the main thing that really draws me to the fascicle is because it's particularly about this really heartbreaking question of why do bad things happen to good people. But we also want to know why do good things happen to bad people, but we don't struggle as much over that question. It's the other one that's so painful for us. And sometimes it's our friends and sometimes it's ourselves, and we just can't understand and it doesn't make sense. It's really painful. It's a very important question. So anyway, this is kind of a great story that I, and a sad story, but it's Dogen's example of taking an unwholesome action and receiving unwholesome results in this lifetime. And so this is a kind of, this is Dogen at his storytelling best, I would say. Long ago, there was a woodcutter who got lost after sunset in the snow on a mountain. He was close to freezing to death. He kept walking, and he saw a bear in the woods. It had a blue body and flaming eyes. The woodcutter was scared and almost fainted. He did not know it was a bodhisattva taking the form of a bear. Seeing that the woodcutter was scared, the bear said, "Don't be afraid. Even if parents and their children have different minds, I will never harbor bad intentions." Then the bear carried the woodcutter into a cave, warmed up his body, and revived him. She brought fruit and roots to feed him. Fearing that the coldness was not going away, she lay with him in her arms. She took care of him in this way for 6 days. On the seventh day, the weather cleared up and the road became visible. The woodcutter came back to himself. Noticing it, the bear thought, brought some sweet fruit and gave it to him as a farewell gift. She took him out of the forest and tenderly said goodbye to him. The woodcutter knelt down and said in gratitude, "What can I do to return your kindness?" The bear said, "I don't want anything in particular from you, but you could protect me just as I have protected you." The woodcutter promised to do so and climbed down the mountain carrying wood. Then he met two hunters who asked, "Have you seen any birds or animals?" The woodcutter said, "I didn't see any birds or animals except a bear." Uh-oh. The hunters asked him to show them where the bear was. The woodcutter said, "I will show you if you will give me 2/3 of what you get." The hunters agreed. The three men went together, killed the bear, and divided the meat 3 ways. When the woodcutter was going to pick up his share of meat, his unwholesome action caused both of his arms to drop off like a broken necklace or cut off lotus roots. The hunters were shocked and asked him what made this happen. Fully ashamed, the woodcutter explained. The hunters scolded him and said, "How could you dare to do such an evil thing to the bear who had been so kind to you? It is amazing that your body has not completely rotted." The three men together donated the meat to a Buddhist temple. A senior monk there with his wondrous wisdom entered samadhi and observed the meat. Then he understood that it was the meat of a great bodhisattva who brings forth benefit to all beings. The monk came out of samadhi and told people about it. They were awed, gathered together fragrant firewood and burnt the meat. They built a stupa to enshrine the remaining bones and held ceremonies of dedication. And that's the end of the story. Kind of puzzling. But that was an example of pretty instant karma in this lifetime, because the man's arms dropped off right away when he did this terrible thing. So that was his immediate karma, his immediate unwholesome results that he received. So then Dogen goes on to explain that the karma that comes from the karma that comes from that is realized in the next lifetime, not this one, is the unwholesome. There are certain category of unwholesome actions which cause the karma to come to you in the next lifetime. And it seems to be the case that the worst, they are worse misdeeds than the karma that can be actually overcome in this lifetime. So there are five types of crimes which for which you will fall into Avicii hell in the next lifetime. And I guess that's a particularly terrible hell. So the five types of Avicii crimes are killing one's father, killing one's mother, killing an arhat, causing a Buddha body to bleed, and harming the community of practitioners of the Dharma wheel, harming the Sangha. That's a very bad thing to do. So those are the things that you have to pay for in the next lifetime. And you spend a long, long eon, a whole eon, which is a very long time, in the Avicii hell, in ceaseless suffering. And depending on how many of those Avicii crimes you have committed, that isn't a time, the time is practically ceaseless, but the suffering is worse. If you commit two of those Avicii crimes, then you suffer twice as much pain as if you only commit one. And if you commit three, then you suffer three times as much pain. I guess the temperature is three times hotter. It just gets worse and worse depending on how many of these crimes you commit. The interesting thing also is that even though there are these specific penances or punishments for specific crimes, and specific hells that you go to depending on what you did, or a particular lifetime in which you have to pay for it. And there's all these complicated, intricate sort of rules about time and intensity of suffering. It's as if there's a minimum sentence for each crime. But the good news is that there is also the chance for mercy. It doesn't use the word mercy, but there's some redemption possible. There's some little cushion here. And this is very striking. Clemency is possible. The minimum sentence can be lifted depending on one's intention and depending on the wholesomeness of one's thoughts. Dogen speaks about a person who has practiced wholesomeness all her life, and she's lying on her deathbed and she sees that she's facing rebirth. Somehow she knows as she's about to pass over, she sees that she's facing rebirth in an intermediate realm, a realm right next to hell. And she asks, why am I facing this intermediate realm right next to hell? I've always practiced wholesomeness and I should be reborn in the Deva realm. That's what she's thinking. But then, being a good person, she stops arguing against it. And she says to herself, I guess, well, I guess maybe I have some tiny little leftover tidbits of bad karma that I didn't really realize. I guess I'm not a perfect person after all. And I guess I still have some karmic debt to pay off. And that's why I have to pay off that debt before I can go to the Deva realm. I have to go to this intermediate realm that could be than entrance to hell because it's right next to hell. It sounds very much like purgatory. But anyway, she is saying, well, I guess I wasn't perfect. So, okay, I have to pay off this last karmic debt. And in that, since that's the case, she says to herself, in the last moments of her life, she decides to focus on wholesomeness. She still has a chance. She's still alive. She focuses totally on wholesomeness, and she remembers wholesome deeds she has done, and she just focuses all her attention on wholesomeness. And because of that, she right then works out the karma by thinking about wholesomeness, and she does not have to go to this intermediate realm, and instead she goes straight to the Deva realm. So there is this possibility of redemption even at the last minute. So it reminds me a bit of the Tolstoy's short story, The Death of Ivan Illich, which is one of my favorite things I recommended. And it's about a man who's not led a very wholesome life at all. And on his deathbed, he suddenly gets it and is kind of awakened. Anyway, I recommend that story. So this is the kindness of Dogen's teaching. There's wiggle room, and what is in your mind and your heart matters. And it appears that in Dogen's view, the arrogance is one of the worst sins of all. It's not named as a precept and not to be arrogant, but like the fox was arrogant, the man who was reborn as a fox was arrogant, believing that he was above the law of cause and effect. Or a person on his deathbed who rails against his karma, refusing to admit he is not perfect. Anyone who insists that they are perfect, that's arrogance, and that doesn't work out well for you. Still, why do bad things happen to good people? It's a perennial question in other religious traditions as well. It's really a problem. It's unbearable, as I was saying. Why are the people of Ukraine being attacked? Is it because of sins they committed in former lives? No, everything in us calls up, no, that's not it. I don't believe in rebirth myself in any literal way. I don't believe that if I behave really badly, I might be reborn as a fox or reborn in Avicii hell. So I still wonder, why do bad things happen to good people? And it's kind of a heretical thing to say, but in a sense, I understand the idea of rebirth as an invention contrived to answer this question of why do bad things happen to good people and why do good things happen to bad people? Because we want people who deserve to be punished. In some sense, we think they should get what they deserve, but we don't see them getting what they deserve. So we suppose, okay, they get it in their next lifetime. And we hate to see innocent people suffer. So maybe it makes us feel better to suppose that, well, they're not really innocent. They must have done something really bad already, and that's why this is happening to them. And in Christianity too, you get punished for bad behavior and you get rewarded for good behavior after you die, because you don't really see it necessarily happening in this life. So in both these religions, this sense of what happens after you die, and in Buddhism it's rebirth, and in Christianity it's heaven or hell. These are ways of kind of evening the score, making things come out right and sort of tying up the loose ends here so that it's fair. Well, that's a kind of cynical view that I've just said. And I actually, even though I don't believe in rebirth, still the law of karma helps me tremendously And I take it in a much wider way. I don't take it as being about just about rebirth, but about, I just believe in the law of karma that says harmful actions produce harmful results. And more importantly, even beneficial actions produce beneficial results. And I just believe that. I have faith in that, thanks to the Dharma and thanks to my Dharma study. We've got to love each other. We may not get to see the results of our actions, but results there will be. Our actions may come to fruition after we die, or they may come to fruition in a different way than we expected that we will never see. It may not be visible to us. Nonetheless, no wholesome deeds are wasted. No kindness is wasted. No love is wasted, ever. And I have to have faith in this because I can't prove it with scientific graphs, but this is faith in the Dharma. And I always think about this in connection with any kind of political work or activism too. I think about it when sometimes the candidate you worked for doesn't get elected. You worked really hard, but you don't get the results you wanted, or the forest you tried to save gets cut down, or the climate you tried to stop from turning into a crisis keeps getting worse in spite of your efforts. So how can you say that your actions are beneficial? Well, there are results from our efforts that we can't see. And then there's another kind of beneficial result that we can see and that we can see right away in our own lifetime. And that's the result of having the feeling of becoming a full human being who is going beyond your small self, having the feeling of realizing your full self by dedicating yourself wholeheartedly to love. And it's the realization of community, of people becoming more and more deeply connected as they work together. These are all karmic effects of beneficial actions. You could call them side effects, but maybe they're the main effect, not side effects. And in the issue of Turning Wheel I mentioned, there's a piece by Tanisaro Bhikkhu about karma, which I thought was very helpful. And he emphasizes the importance of present actions and how time is not so linear. Karma is not so linear as we might assume, that actions in the present change the future, but they also change the present. And actions in the present are the result of actions from the past, but they're also the result of actions right in the present, and that all these different times are connected. And Tanisaro Bhikkhu says that realizing the importance of present actions really brings us freedom. He says, the early Buddhist notion of karma focused on the liberating potential of what the mind is doing with every moment. He was saying that in the early days in Buddha's time, the notion of karma was not an excuse for caste, for example, of saying, well, the lower caste people must have been bad in a former lifetime. He says we give too much weight to the karma of the past. We define ourselves by our ancestry. But, he says, according to Buddha's teachings, this belief that one's dignity is measured not by one's past, but by one's present actions, this belief of Buddha's flew right in the face of the Indian traditions of caste-based hierarchies. I will read you, I have time, my editorial from this issue of Turning Wheel, if you will bear with me. This was written 20 years ago, but I found it instructive when I looked at it today. And it says, I love karma, and here's why. One, it's never too late. There's always a chance to turn things around or set off in a new direction. I can start now. Today is the first day of the rest of my life and all that. It's true that the causes and conditions of the past have spilled me out into this moment. By the same token, what I'm doing right now is part of the karma that shapes my future. After today comes tomorrow, generally speaking. 2, everything I do matters. Even the thoughts I think have an effect on what happens later, maybe in a few minutes, maybe after I die. 3, beneficial actions produce beneficial results, even if we can't see those results. Well, I've already talked to you about that one. 4, it's not all my fault. Karma is a team sport. What comes about thanks to what we all do, including presidents and farm workers and poets and our brother the sun and our sister the moon. So if that tree gets cut down, it's not my fault, especially not if I did my best to save it. For me, it feels good to know I tried. 5, karma makes sense. When I drop a glass on a stone floor, it breaks. When I forget to look at the gas gauge and just keep driving, I run out of gas. When I do barbell curls 3 times a week at the gym, my biceps get bigger. This predictability is reassuring. It gives me something to work with. 6, but we can't predict the future. Even though there's logic to cause and effect, we can't step back far enough to see the full picture. This is a good thing, because if we knew exactly what was going to happen next, life would be very boring. The more complex our act, the less predictable the effect. If I cook bouillabaisse for a friend, I have a reasonable expectation that that will make him happy, but it could turn out that he is allergic to mussels. In the Soto Zen tradition in which I practice, we come together every full moon and we bow a lot and we chant, "All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow." This covers everything. We do this together because we are all in the karmic stream together. Every full moon, and really it's not just every full moon, but every moment, we get to start with a clean slate, all of us together. So now I want to still ask this question again about bad things happening to good people. How does the Dharma and karma help us when something really tragic happens in our lives? When a child dies or something just unimaginably unbearable happens? I don't know the answer to this question. A Christian response, or a certain kind of Christian response, is it's the will of God. God knows what he's doing. It's not for us to know. That's kind of hard to swallow, but it's not so completely different from the teaching of impermanence, it occurs to me. So I want to turn to the 5 remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. So that last one of the 5 remembrances, that's karma. My actions are my only true belongings. And that for me is the most reassuring of them. It's a continuing thing that's always going on, never decided, never finished. We're always accountable. We always have agency. We always have some choice. And I want to end by reading the last 2 paragraphs of this fascicle of Dogen's, number 85. The one that is called, what is it called? Karma in the 3 periods. The world-honored one said, "Effects of an action will never perish. even after 100 and 1,000 eons. One receives the results when the causes and conditions meet. Know that dark actions bring forth dark results. Bright actions bring forth bright results, and mixed actions bring forth varied results. So refrain from taking dark and mixed actions and endeavor to take right actions, bright actions. I like that word, bright actions. The assembly of those who heard the Buddha's discourse accepted it with joy and trust. As the world-honored one says, once wholesome or unwholesome actions are created, they will not perish even after 100, 1,000, or 10,000 eons. One receives the results when the causes and conditions meet. However, unwholesome actions disappear or turn to lighter results by repentance. That's a good one. Wholesome actions increase by rejoicing. This is called never perish. It is not that they do not have effects. So I will end there. And we have some time to go into breakout groups. I'm thinking that you might want to talk about, well, you might want to talk about anything that's come up for you as I've about karma that I've been speaking about, but a possible focus could be how do you see, how have you seen or felt? Let's take the positive side. How have you seen or felt wholesome results from wholesome actions in your own life? Or anything else you want to address about karma? And let's go into groups of three and let's take 5 minutes each. And let's come back. Jane, let's come back at about, let's see, 20 of, does that make sense? Yeah, let's take 4 minutes each and let's come back at about 20 of. Is that okay, Jane?